Coming up on this week's show, Nintendo revived their biggest failure.
iPod click wheel games get preserved.
And we go inside the world of Omega 6 with Takaya Imamura and Junji Seki.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our friends, our sponsor, A Bitmap Books. Now, of course, today, lots of Nintendo on the show. If you are a Nintendo fan, one of their books you absolutely should check out, Super Nintendo / Super Famicom, A Visual Compendium. A real love letter to the system that really changed the gaming landscape back in the early 90s. And a snapshot of the best games, developers, box art and product design from all across the different territories. If you love the Super Nintendo, check it out. Weighing in at more than 500 pages, you can see it and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our friends at PCB Way. Now, of course, PCB Way, you know them, big supporters of the retro community. Maybe right now you're in the market for a fully featured custom PCB prototype. They've got you covered. Low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards. They love working on retro projects as well. They also offer services like 3D printing and injection molding, and they're massive supporters of the retro community. So get an instant quote right now on their website at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 498. Your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to this week's show, the podcast that comes out every single Friday and, of course, celebrates everything that there is about the world of old school video games and technology. You know, we cover all sorts on this show. It can be the arcades from back in the 70s, 80s and 90s, the 8-bit micros, the 16-bit machines, the consoles.
The handhelds, don't forget that.
We cover it all on this podcast. And incredible guests on the show every single Friday. Another one to tell you about in just a minute. But of course, the big news is they're coming up. I mean, I did mention that we're on episode number 498. That means only 2 weeks to go until the big 500. That just sounds surreal saying that, doesn't it?
It's bonkers. Yeah, I think we're going to celebrate it in style, though. Me and Joe, actually, I've done a really interesting interview. You're not involved, Dan, for the 500.
I thought we'd let the good, you know, the decent guys be on for the big celebration. Mm-hmm. I'll sit back. That's the real stars of the show.
And you know, I think the guest we've got is going to be a two-parter, and it's a very kind of a guest with a wide-ranging history. Mm-hmm. That you know, starts from the very beginning. So that's where we're going to kind of leave that little hint. But yeah, we're not going to divulge that anymore. But you guys can get involved as well. So previously we had like a message board kind of voicemail thing where you could leave messages. We've seen pictures of people all over the world and where they kind of listen to the podcast, which is always cool to see. So we'd love to hear your messages, like over the decade, how you've listened to the Retro Hour, what some of your favourite episodes are, but also, like, I'd love to see different locations where people are listening. Not in the bath. Just
we've had a few of them, actually. Yeah.
Keep them clean, yeah.
So basically, we want you guys to be part of our 500th episode celebrations, because it is going to be a party in a couple of weeks' time. So we're going to be opening the voicemail and video mail lines as well, because we're going to go full video from episode 500. So if you'd like to leave us maybe just a little good luck message, it can be anything at all. I mean, we got quite a few of them when we did our 400th one, so we'd like to do it again. So if you head to our website, theretrohour.com, leave us a little like voicemail-style message. We'll play a bunch of them out on the 500th episode. So all the details, you can find that link right now on the website, theretrohour.com. And we did mention episode 500 as well. We are going to be going full video. So we're going to be doing the news on YouTube. So you can get a look at our wonderful faces. Anything could happen as well. For example, right now, you know, I've just realised I'm actually drinking a can of Pepsi out of a Coca-Cola glass.
Wild, yeah, Dan.
Playing
with
fire.
These days, you're a madman.
You'll get to see all that. So, yeah, we're looking forward to episode 500. So just a real celebration of us getting halfway to 1,000, which I'm sure will come up soon. But we have got a podcast to concentrate on this week. So today's going to be a bit of a part two.
Yeah, so we had Takaya Imamura on, and we got some feedback, actually. People said, what an epic effort and quality edit that was, Dan, as well, because that's really hard, you know, doing two languages. And he sent me a screenshot of his timeline.
It looked like I was basically mastering an Aphex Twin album on my
It was a hell of a timeline. And you know, Takaya mentioned in his interview that he did Omega 6, which was this original kind of story that, you know, got the eyes of Nintendo and Miyamoto, and that has now turned into a game. So he's not the only person working on the game as well. There's Junji Seki as well, who's the president of Happy Meal. There's a lot of their team, and they've kind of taken this graphic novel format and they've created a game, a very unique Japanese-style game with some very retro elements as well as some modern stuff. They've brought it to the Switch. It's been massively popular, and it's actually been a physical edition from Limited Run Games. Dark Horse Comics have done a version, and it's really interesting because Junji himself has a good history of video games, doesn't he, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, developed a few games back in the day for the arcade, Sega Saturn as well, the PlayStation. But actually, one thing that's really interesting about him is he's got a real passion for the classic systems and even preservation as well. He runs a museum, actually, doesn't he?
Yeah. So he's got a museum about video cartridges in Japan as well.
The cassette museum, but cassette means something different in Japan. Cartridges are basically cassettes.
And he really likes ones where people have wrote their own names on it, or they're claimed or signed the cartridges. So he's got a huge collection there, and we talked to him about his passion, but then also what it was like getting together with Takaya Imamura. But then, like, Nintendo's attitude to the Switch as well, which is really interesting to hear about what it was like internally when the Switch arrived. So there's some really, really interesting points there that really stood out to us when we heard them. We're a bit like, wow, because we've heard certain stuff about Nintendo and the Switch, and this turns on his head a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, because Imamura left in 2021. So the Switch was in like full swing then. So some interesting behind the scenes stuff that, like we said last week, we don't get many stories from inside the world of Nintendo. So a little rare peek behind the curtain. So a bit of a part two. Our chat with Takaya Imamura continues this week inside the world of Omega 6, joined by Junji Seki. And they're on the show in around half an hour from now. But of course, first half of the podcast, that's when we get to geek out a bit about what's been happening in the world of retro gaming and technology from over the last week. And actually, we're starting with something that Ravi sent us this on our little Facebook Messenger group.
I thought Nintendo would be all over this originally.
No.
let's not make this stick.
I had to check the date. I thought, surely this is a prank. But actually, it's not. And this is something I really thought Nintendo would rather kind of scrub the history books of. But it turns out they're actually going to be celebrating the Virtual Boy.
First, have any of you guys used one?
Yes. Still got the scars.
No.
I've never used one myself. No. What's it like?
It was very red. Funny that. Literally, yeah. I've used them at like gaming shows. I've looked inside them, and I think it was the Mario game that I played on there. Is it like Mario Tennis or something, I want to say?
It's Mario Tennis. Don't get me started on Mario Tennis.
I remember that coming up in our Christmas quiz a couple of years ago. Mario's Tennis, wasn't it? Not Mario Tennis?
Yeah.
One of the two, anyway.
Yeah.
Little inside joke. I have, and I completely see why it failed. And it was obviously one of Nintendo's, if not their biggest failure in history. But turns out Nintendo, obviously, they kind of see the funny side of it now, three decades on, because you're going to get to be able to play Virtual Boy games complete with a headset accessory on your Nintendo Switch very soon.
Yeah, I think it was one of them, like, you didn't believe it when you saw it, when they announced it. And it was like, okay, this is really, really cool. And it's cool to see, like, Nintendo actually kind of, like, getting over themselves.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's something they've well and truly buried. I think people were surprised when it was actually at the Nintendo Museum in Japan. You know, they actually had like a section for it. But Ravi did make a really good point about it when we saw the announcement the other day. He said, have they just run out of like retro ideas now?
A sign of desperation. We've got nothing else. Let's do the Virtual Boy.
Yeah, basically it does feel a little bit like that. And literally, like, I was walking with my daughter earlier on, and I was thinking about it. Like, I was deep in thought. She's like waving a stick around, and I was deep in thought, and I was like, you know, it's cool to see the Virtual Boy, but they still could do an N64 Mini. They could still do a GameCube Mini. They've not run out of stuff just yet. But in terms of like backwards compatible console, like games for the Switch, then basically they've run out.
They want people to sign up to the online service, and they're obviously looking for new things all the time to entice people. It's interesting. I thought, is a virtual boy going to actually entice anyone? But I thought, yeah, I would be curious to try out some of these games. I mean, there's only, what, 14 games?
So there was 19 games released for the Virtual Boy across the different territories, but there's only 14 coming out. And I need to do a little bit more into that. But I've read there was 19 games and there's 14 coming out, so I'm not 100% sure.
And it's interesting how it works as well, because it is just a Virtual Boy headset, but you open it up and you put the Switch inside, which I think is just a really cool idea. It becomes like an extravagant case for it, really.
Well, do you remember like Google Cardboard, those like VR little headsets that you could make, a bit like that?
Well, the thing is, the Virtual Boy had this like strap that, you know, a stand that you'd have on the table. Like, my dream has always been to attach it to my face.
Masking it,
yeah. To walk around with it on. Yeah.
There's a really cool video. I say really cool, funny video from about 15, 16 years ago, YouTube. Guy called Keith Apicary, who used to be on like game trailers and stuff like that, and was in there with like the whole video game nerd, angry video game nerd crowd and stuff. But he literally did a music video for a song called like the Virtual Boy song that he did. And the music video is him just walking around in the streets of like America. And he's done that rather, and he's got a Virtual Boy masking tape to his head. But because he's actually a stuntman, like his real profession is he's a stuntman, so he's like falling off buildings into skips and stuff with it on, and it's like ridiculous. I did just have a look. It is the full library, 14 games.
Right.
Is the
full library.
Yeah,
no, there wasn't many. Yeah.
But there was 5 games that basically didn't come out, but have all been dumped, and ROMs and stuff all exist of it since. So there was 19 games developed for it, but only 14 of them came out.
Well, as you mentioned as well, so basically they're going to be releasing this this plastic headset that looks the same form factor as the original Virtual Boy. You open the top of it. It actually works with the Switch 1 as well.
Yeah, so
one
that's
or two,
cool.
Yeah, which you can pop in. And then you can play, obviously it's going to be close to your eyes. You can play those. There weren't VR games, there were stereoscopic games in that kind of red and black colour. Not sure if it's going to come with the stand. It makes sense if it did. The pictures are quite zoomed in.
It looks like it does. I've just been on the actual Nintendo website. And it has the stand in all their pictures.
Right.
And they've listed it for £66.99 on there.
Okay.
Because I saw literally an article this morning being like, where could you buy it from? How much is it going to be? But it's on there, on the Nintendo website, for February 17th, 2026.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. It does say the games will be released over time. So all 14 games won't come out at once, yeah. So
they want to stay subscribed. So
and to be fair, the Virtual Boy is quite an expensive console, isn't it?
So it's like £500, I think.
Yeah, this does give you access to actually have the experience. Whether it's going to be a disappointing present for kids at Christmas,
I might get a daughter one.
Thanks, Dad.
I'm curious. Have they addressed the migraines that the original caused? And the fact that
it's kind of a nicer screen, like, I imagine, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess that was CRT driven.
I'm not sure what the tech was.
What gets me is, I'm sure I read LCD. Somewhere saying it's only compatible with the Labo thing and putting it in the actual Virtual Boy. Like, I was a bit like, could you not just hold your Switch right up to your eyes?
Make
like,
your own cereal box.
I was a bit like, you know, like, what's stopping you from just, obviously I'm sure we'll find out when it comes out, but like, can you not just play it just looking at it? Like, I don't.
I can imagine YouTube videos like, I fit my Steam Link into a Virtual Boy. And, there'll be lots of weird hacks and modifications going on.
I mean, again, like you guys said, the Virtual Boy, it's an expensive system now. It's definitely a collectible. It's nothing I ever remember seeing back in the day. I can't even remember if it came out in the UK. I ever remember seeing it.
I don't think it did.
Yeah, I don't ever remember seeing that back in the 90s. But obviously I'm aware of it now, and I'm a bit curious. Like I said, I've played with it for a couple of seconds at, you know, expos and that kind of thing.
Do you think this will help in overall restoring the reputation of the Virtual Boy? You know, maybe some new kids get it and go like, this was the first virtual reality, and then play with it and not see it as that bad a thing.
I mean, any system has got its hardcore fans. You guys know I like the Jaguar, which is not a general consensus in the retro gaming world. And there will be people that love the Virtual Boy, I'm sure, who will love this. I imagine for most people, like, if I buy this, it'll be something I play for 20 minutes and then we'll end up on a shelf or in a drawer, never to be used again, I imagine. What about you, Joe? Are you curious? Because obviously you know, you've got a Switch.
Yeah, I'm curious. I think it'll probably, like all Nintendo accessories, it'll probably sell out really quickly. I was just looking now to see if you can actually pre-order it. It said to log in, which I've not done. I'll have a look after this. I don't know. Like, obviously it's compatible with the Switch 1, which is nice. I don't have a Switch 2. I want it, but the reality of it is I'll play it like once or twice.
Yeah.
And then it'll be on the shelf. And then it's just cool to be like, oh, I've got it in my collection. You know,
that's one other thing. I think there will be people that are Switch completionists who want every add-on that Nintendo released for it. So yeah. I think, yeah, that they're probably a big market.
I'm just waiting for the Wii U gamepad version.
Well, that'd be good. Wouldn't surprise me now. I'd have thought, you know, Nintendo would have written the Virtual Boy off.
But, give it 30 yeah, years. That,
yeah, yeah, be patient, Revy.
Combo with the two failed products.
So, yeah, if you want to play Virtual Boy games on your Switch 1 or 2, that is going to be available from next February with the full game library on there. So something to be excited about for 2026. Now, I think this is quite cool as well. Something that I didn't play all that often, I've got to admit, but I am an iPod collector. Don't know how this happened. I got my first iPod in around 2002, upgraded gradually, but always kept my original ones. Or I think I might give some to my mum and then she gave them back to me. And then I've suddenly ended up with like everyone's kind of given me their old iPods that they don't want anymore. All the families, I've got about 30 of them now, all the different ones you could imagine. Haven't played many Click Wheel games on them, but this actually reminded me of this story because they were a short-lived thing, weren't they? That before the iPhone came along, you could actually buy games for your iPod that you would play with the click wheel, the little round wheel on the iPod, that you could buy from iTunes and download them to your iPod, which I'd completely forgotten was a thing. And I imagine most people did.
I don't have much memory of this. I think it was Breakout or...
Yeah, that came built in, didn't it?
Arkanoid that was like built in, yeah. And I remember there was a quiz one as well, like a music quiz.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's literally my only memories of gaming. And it's a weird interface. And also, you know, everything was different screen sizes, weren't they? Because you had the little kind of fat iPod models and then you had the nanos later on. And I couldn't imagine any games came out for the Shuffle.
You can imagine. Well, originally you mentioned, yeah, Brick. That was a game that came included with the original iPod. Obviously, yeah, that was it. It was Steve Wozniak made that originally, didn't they, back in the day? So it makes sense they had that in there. Then they added a few other ones. It went along. Parachute was one that I do remember, actually. Solitaire was in there. They had Music Quiz. Then they offered these iPod games available for sale through the iTunes store. Now, we're talking about the original Clicker Wheel, not the iPod Touch here. But obviously, they turned that service off over a decade ago. But it turns out there has been a preservation effort that I've got a feeling we did mention on this podcast when it first started about a year ago.
Yeah,
they've now completed it. So basically, there was 54 games that you could buy for the iPod that have now been preserved via a GitHub community project.
Wasn't there something like some of them were, you know, taken off the store, but they hadn't been updated and they stayed within some of the iPods and they were trying to extract them? I think that's kind of what I remember. And, you know, it was like a race to get these off the iPods and preserved. But if they've got that full collection of 54... That's quite interesting. You can get your iPods and sync them up, Dan, and then get some of these old games off GitHub, which is pretty cool.
I think I definitely will. Yeah, sorry.
I was wondering, how do we play them then? Do we literally download them for our iPod, like your old iPods then?
Yeah, I mean, basically the way it worked originally was, people would send their iPods into this guy. His name is Oslo, who's behind this project. But then he invented an emulator to take them off. Right. So, but they do say in this article that what you can do is you can download them from GitHub. And if you've got a Windows formatted iPod, you can then basically, I was going to say squirt them over to your iPod. That was Zune, though, wasn't it? Squirt. You can sync it to your iPod and basically play the games on your original machine. In terms of whether there's an iPod emulator, I'm not sure. It does mention something about a virtual machine here, but yeah, I'm not sure.
I've never, ever, ever used an iPod. Ever.
Well, you never owned an iPod?
Never owned one. I've got an iPhone. I've had iPhones since.
So what did you have before that?
CDs, man.
I had a mini disc.
I just had cheap MP3 players.
It doesn't mention which iPods it uses here. It just says iPod click wheel. I mean, I can't imagine they're going to work on like the very first iPod. So obviously, like you said, right, there's different versions
with different screens.
Yeah, different resolutions. And I can imagine processors as well.
Some interesting games that came out on it, though. There's an official Scrabble game. Pac-Man and Miss Pac-Man, officially from Namco, were released on it too. Mystery Mansion Pinball. How on earth would you play pinball on an iPod?
Well, you'll find out that.
Go find out, Dan Forrest.
And actually, looking about the scroll wheel, that would be quite nice for pinball, I reckon. You'd get like a nice feeling aesthetic.
Left and right, left. Yeah, could maybe work. A few Sims games came out from EA. The Sims Bowling and The Sims DJ. The Sims Pool was released on there as well. Tetris, which I can imagine that working quite well. There's a Tamagotchi game on there too. So, 54 games came out on it. And you can basically play them on your old school iPod now as well. It looks like there could be a virtual machine that he's invented that you can play them on as well, looking at the GitHub. If you haven't got your original iPod, it looks like that could be a way to play them. But I think, it's nothing that I was ever really that interested in. I mean, you guys know, and I think all three of us are the same. I don't even game on my iPhone, to be honest.
To be honest, no. I have more interest in the Nokia games and those kind of ones, because that was when I was at school searching for games and any kind of entertainment to distract me from classes. So I've got a lot of nostalgia for those. And I saw, we've covered a lot of like old Nokia game making competitions and stuff. And maybe this might spur some people on to code some iPod games or convert some stuff over.
Now, it's interesting. I was reading a story the other day about, and obviously, Bradley, you work in the education sector. I don't know if you've seen anything like this, but there's a story, apparently a bit of a movement at the moment because kids, their phones are getting banned from school. So like the school's saying you can't bring your phone in, but apparently they're allowed to bring stuff like iPods in. So I imagine the reason that they weren't allowing them to bring their phones in is obviously messaging and stuff, playing games. This might mess up that whole thing now of letting them bring iPods in. If everybody
turns up with a click wheel iPod, I'll let you know. Yeah.
With 54 games pre-installed, they're not going to get any work done, Ravi.
But to be honest, if you give a kid a stick, they'll be, they'll make hours of entertainment out of distraction. Yeah.
So I think, I am going to definitely get this installed and hooked up on one of my iPods, though. So I think just for game preservation, which obviously we talk about a lot, we're big proponents of preserving these games. Great effort. If you want to check those out, I'll link that in this week's show notes. Now, we'll follow up to another story that we covered earlier this year. We mentioned that legendary company from back in the day, Acclaim, were making a comeback. We had Argonaut Software as well, who came back earlier this year as well. It's been a bit of a year for classic brands making a return. And Acclaim actually did their first announcement, the Play Acclaim Showcase, to give us a little glimpse at some new games that are coming out from them.
Yeah, so this is interesting. So I think a lot of people, and they probably still will, but a lot of people were expecting Acclaim to be like, right, here's Turok.
Yeah.
Here's some of the bigger IPs that we worked on and developed, etc. But interestingly, this video they've put out, it's about 10 minutes long, I think, is it's all, as far as I'm aware, it's all original IPs. They're all brand new.
Yeah.
Games that they've released. And there's quite a few on there. There's a good 10 games, but they're all retro inspired games, some like kind of like, polygon 3D games, as well as a lot of 2D games. And they're all very kind of like inspired by classic IPs. Some of them are very Prince of Persia looking, and like Shinobi looking. Like there's one called Talica, which looks pretty cool. There's also one that caught my eye. I think it was called Pixel Power Wash. I like my Power Wash Simulator.
Yeah.
It was a Power Wash game. You play as a little cat, but in like a 2D pixelated top-down view, cleaning things. With a Power Washer. You're a little cat with a Power Washer. Cleaning museums.
I think you could be a pig as well and stuff.
Yeah.
It does look good. I think this is different methods of gameplay reformatted and kind of put in retro form, and it's quite nice actually. They all look quite innovative and they all feel like indie games. Looking at them,
they've definitely got an indie game feel, 100% from what you said there. I'm not sure, these are all separate games though, aren't they?
Yeah,
by the looks of things, it's not like a compilation of all these different games. And from the articles I've read, I've only read two articles on this, but it doesn't seem clear that, like, I'm going to assume they're going to come to all modern console.
No, just PC at the moment.
Right.
There's a comment at the top of the, it's pinned by them on the trailer. If you go through to YouTube, it says, we're thrilled to share that while all our games are confirmed for PC, we are exploring console releases. So, that's so far, PC only, but I mean, it would make sense to at least get them on the Switch.
Yeah, Switch, PS4 seems to be, you know, one of the, a lot of indie games go for, you know, because it's still going.
There's a snowboarding game that looks very kind of Jet Set Radio future style, but also a bit like mixed with Splatoon or something like that. Yuki and... yeah, it looks like they've all been inspired by different things and they're kind of bringing them together. But it's nice. I reckon they were all working on these projects separately and then just decided to drop it all at the same time.
It's interesting. There is a game on there called Basketball Classics. Obviously, they published the NBA Jam games back in the day. Doesn't look quite on the level of NBA Jam, I've got to be honest.
It's like 8-bit style, isn't it?
Some of the graphics are like they were drawn in like paint on Microsoft Paint.
But then it's really smooth and I quite like the look of that one. And I'm not a sports game person at all. I did quite like the look of that one. I was like, oh, that looks pretty cool. Like 5-on-5 arcade action. But it's like, it also reminds me of old school Mortal Kombat because it's like, you have to, you know, like to test your might and stuff. Like the game stops and you have to do that to like slam dunk by the looks of things.
It reminds me of Broforce as well, the way that you've got the smaller kind of pixel characters and it's zooming in and out.
Yeah, it does look pretty cool. And I think you're right there, Ravi. I didn't really notice all the different types of like old school kind of like 80s and 90s arcade kind of like style of gaming they've kind of got in there. You know, like you say, it's different games. Like I just said, where you've got to tap the button. Different games, you know, all different kind of styles, like side-along platforms, side-along action games, you know, the snowboarding game there. So, yeah, I'm really surprised they've announced this without console announcements. So, really surprised at that.
And I think each one of these games would be like something we'd be covering separately as well. And to see it all as a big bunch is pretty cool.
Yeah.
I'm more surprised it came back with this. I mean, a lot of the comments are like, oh yeah, Claim's back. Where's Shadow Man? Where's Turok? It does kind of feel a bit...
I think of another one, yeah.
Yeah, Burnout as well, obviously. But yeah, I think it's... I think a lot of people may be hoping for like... Which, you know, might come. I imagine it probably will at some point if you know, they still own kind of all the trademarks and rights to those games. But yeah, I think there does seem to be a little bit of a feeling of, oh, hang on, a Claim's back, and it's basically an indie games producer.
I guess, like, maybe, you know, if you've got one of those big titles, then you have to put a load of effort into it, have loads of developers, whereas this, you can, you know, just do loads of them, get them out there, see what hits, make a bit of money, and then, you know, maybe hit those ones later.
Baby steps.
Baby steps.
Yeah. So, some of the old IPs coming back obviously would be great, but I think, you know, it's a nice little first step out there. Some of these games look quite playable as well. Like you said, I love the fact that they're kind of really going in on the retro thing. If you watch their little video, it starts with like a CRT monitor. All the graphics and visuals on there are very kind of 80s and 90s inspired. So they're really leaning in on the retro thing, which makes sense. So, we'll keep an eye on those. No release dates or anything as yet. If you want to check out that trailer, I'll shove that in this week's show notes as well. Obviously, only a few weeks away from Halloween. This is generally around the time of year when Joe and I kind of have a little think about what games we're going to play. Bit of a tradition, isn't it, that we're going to our spooky on?
Play the spooky games. I haven't played Resident Evil. I'm ahead of you already.
You can see you play all year round, don't you? but this is something that actually looks pretty cool. This looks quite a creepy game. This is an adventure. You can actually download the demo of this now, an alien-inspired point-and-click horror for the Mega Drive.
Yeah, I've seen a few of these point-and-click horrors for the Mega Drive recently, and they've definitely got, like, an aesthetic that they all kind of, like, copy with, like, pixelated kind of, like, it looks like real photographs, you know, that you kind of, like, clicking on and stuff, you know, like, photographs of, like, the astronauts here.
Yeah, it's kind of digitized.
But it's actually like artwork, basically, that's been made. But yeah, this is the ARC, the demo, as Dan's just said, that's come out. Very interesting game. It is a point-and-click adventure, which you can move around in first-person segments and then obviously arrive to areas where you have to like click on things and kind of like reveal the mystery. Incredibly alien-inspired. I'm actually watching through Alien Earth at the moment. on Disney Plus, which I've been really enjoying because I love the Alien franchise.
I was going to say, sidetracking there, everyone I've spoken to said that's awful.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm enjoying it.
You know, when I see this, I immediately think of The Dig. And, you know, I think the name The Ark kind of points to that, the classic LucasArts point and click one, you know, especially with the space scenes and the kind of just renders and the dust and how it looks with that and just kind of alien theming it as well, which I really like, so the writing where it's just literal lines.
That they've put in there.
So,
the plot of it is you play as a engineering crew, which are called Yutani Engineers, and it's obviously famously an alien. The company is called Weyland Yutani, and you play as these engineers who encountered a colossal space entity in the darkest corner of, like, the void, it basically says, and then you cross paths with another spacecraft, which is called the Levine, I think. And you join forces with them, and basically you have to kind of like survive and figure out the mystery of it all by the looks of things. I'm not clear if it is actually playable on the Mega Drive at this point. I imagine it will be because they're saying
it's
a Mega Drive game.
It is,
okay, that's cool. So you just download it onto a flash card, the demo, I'm guessing, and then play it on there.
Or an emulator,
Or an emulator. Yeah. And then I'm assuming when the game is finished, they'll probably put it out as a Kickstarter or as a limited kind of like purchasing run or something. But it's cool to see the Mega Drive getting, not just, you know, it's always getting love at the moment, but, you know, I guess a genre that wasn't very popular on the Mega Drive at the time.
And this is split up into two areas, because basically it's the first bit of the game, they call it the first narrative segment of the game that they finished off. So, you start with a first-person onboarding sequence and you've got a nice cutscene there as well. Then it goes into a traditional point-and-click adventure-style third-person experience as well. Then they reckon there's also going to be like exploration and puzzle-solving. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be, you know, you've got to explore various areas of the ships as well. Really focusing on, again, inspired by Alien, that kind of feeling of claustrophobia as well in the game too. And there are, I mean, it's very early. They're putting this out there really for a bit of feedback by the looks of it. And also by the looks of it, I'm not sure quite how long they're going to be leaving this up there. They say for a limited time, they're making it available. This is a team called Area Form, which I'm not sure if it's just one guy, but it's an indie games company from Iceland. And there are some problems. You mentioned that there is some slowdowns and some bugs at the moment too.
Okay.
But you can download it if you want to try it out. And like you said, Joe, I imagine this is going to be something where it hopefully does develop into a full game.
Yeah.
And he's putting it out there just for a bit of feedback on it, really, which, again, I mean, I love point-and-click adventure games. It's always been one of my favourite genres, so I'll definitely give this a download and stick it on my EverDrive and check it out, because, looks really cool.
You have to let us know on Halloween if it spooked you.
Now, just one final story before we hop into our interview, part two of the chat with Takai Imamura and Junji Seki from the awesome Retro Messer event in Norway, talking about the World of Omega 6 in a minute. Now, this one is, we're talking about point-and-click adventures. This leads quite nicely into our final story this week. Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis. Obviously, that was a legendary LucasArts adventure back in the day. We've done entire episodes about that. Hal Barwood and Noah Falstein had them both on the show, talking about that before. And it was an interesting game. So basically, it was their attempt to make an authentic-feeling sequel to the movies, wasn't it?
It had its entire own script. Own storyline. Really cool game, actually. I enjoyed it on the Amiga. That's what I used to play it on. Did you play it much, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, it's nothing I played back in the day, actually, but I played it in more recent years. I think it was around the time we did the interview with Hal Barwood, because it was one that I used to read about it in magazines, but it, shall I say, it never crossed my path.
Well, also,
by the way, I got Amiga games back then.
Scum Engine's a great way to play it as well.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people have been revisiting it on Scum.
Yeah. And it's a really funny game as well. I think, like a lot of those kind of classic LucasArts adventure, a lot of people regard it as the best video game based on Indiana Jones. You know, there's been some awful ones over the years.
Do you have time to play all these point and clicks? That's the question.
Absolutely not. No chance. But, you know, you can always make time if you give up other things. You know, you work and wait till Monday, Ravi. But this one is a new version of Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis that has now been demade for the humble ZX Speccy. They've actually turned this into a text adventure.
You could play this in your Spectrum Next now, Dan.
Yeah.
I think this looks really cool. It's a reimagining. Of course, you've got the intro screen. You've got the whole world put in there. I just think the amount of effort to go through a game and convert it in this way is pretty insane. So it's by a Czech developer, Kamel, probably going to say this wrong, Blazek.
Yep.
And it's multi-language, so it's got Czech and English in there, and it's for the Spectrum 48K. It looks really interesting. It's your typical kind of text adventure. Move north, south, east, west, you know, explore the world in that way. So what he's obviously done is gone through every single scene, converted that into text, and then converted all the items that you're going to get in your inventory. That whole system must be just insane to kind of do. I think it's actually quite a good way for fans who already play the game to explore it. And, you know, if people play it in a certain manner or a certain way, it might be interesting to see what pops up on the screen in text if you're a really big fan of it. And nice to see it, you know, go onto another system.
I do like some old school text adventures. I mean, you know, famously, there was a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah.
I've talked about that on the show before. You know, it was one of those that almost made me want to throw my Amiga out the window. Such a frustrating game. But I played stuff like, you know, Zork as well. I used to enjoy that. I had an adventure on the Acorn Electron.
I wrote one with my friend, which featured Tony Blair in it, chasing you. I was had fun with text adventures.
Is he the main boss?
Yeah. And text adventure creation, yeah.
Yeah, I do like a good text adventure, though, because, I mean, it's a bit cliche, but it's kind of like, you know, you create the pictures in your mind, don't you? It's like reading a storybook. So one thing, it's I'm looking at this, and it's got a beautiful loading screen as well.
Yes, yeah, there's some nice art in
the Spectrum. One thing I remember, some of the later type-in adventure games, they would have, like, half the screen would be graphics at the top.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, I mean, looking at the incredible job they've done on the artwork here, I think that could work quite well for this game. Obviously, it's a bit of a bigger job. They've got to do several different scenes for it. But yeah, I think it's kind of a bit of a shame with those skills we've obviously got that there isn't maybe more in there. But obviously, I mean, it's this is just a standard old school type in text adventure, you know, with your movements, press N to go north, S to go south. Some of these games, though, your enjoyment was kind of dictated by how good the parser was.
Yes.
Some of them could be quite frustrating, couldn't they? You know, I want to go east, I type E. That doesn't work. E-A-S-T. Oh, now I know what you mean. Some of them were a bit frustrating back then, but hopefully they've learned from the mistakes of the past.
It's something I'd love to get back into.
Yeah.
Like, if I was trapped on a desert island, I'd love just an archive of text adventures. That would kind of be a good way of getting through them, because I just simply don't have the time now. But yeah, and it does encourage reading as well and imagination.
Yeah, so these are available to download for free by the looks of it. I imagine probably wouldn't dare charge for an Indiana Jones game. You know, obviously piggybacking on that franchise. Hopefully this will go under the radar, though, but you can get these now. I'd advise you to be quick, though, if you do want them, like we always say with these kind of things. And like you said, Ravi, will work on the Next as well. Obviously a lot of new users coming in on that platform because of the recent Kickstarter. So I'll link that if you want to download it for your Speccy. And, of course, all the rest of this week's stories in this week's show notes. A reminder as well that we do have a patron that supports this podcast, and that patrons are actually going to be getting, fingers crossed we're working on this, a live stream of episode 500 that we're going to be doing in a couple of weeks' time. We've just been playing around with that tonight. So if you want to watch us.
It's going to be hard for us because you guys don't see us swearing in the background and all of the kind of madness that goes on. Dan's dog is popping up every half an hour to say hello, you know. So yeah, it's going to be interesting doing a live stream for patrons. You'll get to see the backstage of the retro.
Yeah, how unslick we actually are. looking forward to that. And of course, lots more perks for being a patron. We do hangouts every month as well.
Yeah.
They're always a giggle. We do those last Sunday of the month. And one coming up on the 28th from 8 p.m. UK time. Basically a massive Zoom call, Google Meet, actually. We all get together, geek out for a couple of hours. We do a bonus podcast called The Retro Hour After Hours. New episode of that just dropped last week as well. So plenty of perks to support this show and keep us going well beyond episode 500. All the details over at theretrohour.com. Now, before we chat to this week's special guests, Imamura and Seki San coming up live from Retro Mesa in Norway inside the world of Omega 6. Let's take a second to give a huge thank you to a regular supporter of the Retro Hour podcast, and that is our wonderful friends at Shopify. Now, you know Shopify by now, but the ones with the sound that we love hearing. You know, that sound is Ravi.
That's the sound of success.
Yes, sound of making a sale on Shopify, because they are the all-in-one commerce platform that can help you grow your business, basically take care of everything you need to run a successful online or in-person business in 2025. Now, the thing is, they scale with how big you want to be as well, because, yeah, you know, household names use them, Mattel, Gymshark.
Bitmap Books.
Yeah. They sell those. We've been selling ours on there as well. Obviously, we're nowhere near the league of those companies. So however big you want to grow, they'll grow with you as well. And what's great about it is they basically give everything you need to have a beautiful online store without any coding knowledge needed whatsoever.
Yeah, it's super simple. You know, you can just do drag and drop, create a store. They've got a huge series of templates. But also, if you're a bit like me and you like to get into the coding as well, you can do that. There's options for checkouts as well, which I love. You can like have discount codes, apply them, and also sell in person. So if you've got one of those point of sale units, you're at a show, you need to make a sale, instantly you can do that, and also check your inventory, check your stock, see if the products are there, but do digital delivery as well. So people can order stuff. We've got our PDF on there, and instantly it gets delivered to our customers, which is awesome.
And watermarked as well, which obviously is important if you're selling digital books, that kind of thing. It's packed with helpful AI tools as well. Now, everything's got AI built in now, but actually the ones on Shopify are great. It can help you with the product descriptions, your headlines, even enhance your photography to get, you know, your products popping off the website and your page. Also, like having a marketing team behind you as well, help you create your email and social media campaign. So wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling, Shopify is there. They're basically an all-in-one commerce expert with world-class expertise. Everything from managing inventory, international shipping, processing returns, and much more as well. So if you sell anything at all, you're ready for Shopify. So why don't you give it a try and turn your big business idea into cold, hard... Thanks to our friends at Shopify by your side. Now, if you want to give it a go, it's a no-brainer. You can try it out for just £1 a month. Use our link, the one that we sent you, shopify.co.uk/retrohour. That's our exclusive link to get you that discount. Try it out for just £1 a month, shopify.co.uk/retrohour. I'll put that in this week's show notes. And a big thank you to our friends at Shopify for their continued support of the show. All right, the little reminder, episode 500 coming up a week after next. So we do have that voicemail and video message on our website right now. We'd love, I mean, obviously we said this now, we do need some messages, so we'd really appreciate if you send us some. And obviously join us for the massive episode 500 celebrations. All the details at theretrohour.com. And next, going to be chatting to this week's special guest, recorded live at Retro Mesa in Norway. Part two of our chat with Nintendo legend Takaya Imamura, joined by Junji Seki this week as we go inside the world of Omega 6. Next on the Retro Hour podcast. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to day two of Retro Mesa 2025. My name is Dan Wood, and this is Ravi Abbott, and we host a podcast that comes out every single Friday called The Retro Hour. Now, you can get that on all the usual places, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube as well. And the idea of the show is that we bring you up to speed on what's been happening in retro gaming from over the last week, and also where the show really comes into its own, I think, is when we welcome on industry legends to tell us the story about their career, which is exactly what we're going to be doing this morning.
Yes, today we've got Junji Seki and Takaya Imamura, and we're going to be talking about Omega 6, the Triangle Stars, and these guys have worked together on this game. We're going to talk about how it was kind of formed and the collaboration, and also what happens with the game as well, because there's physical releases, there's a lots of different things going on with it, and it's a very interesting story. So this is the first time we've had Junji on the panel, Seki-san. So I was wondering what were the first arcade games you played and how you got into arcades?
Arcade?
Yeah.
Maybe the Donkey Kong? Space Invader.
Oh, not all.
Space Invader as well. Yes, yes. That was Imamura-san's as well. You've worked on a few arcade titles as well, helping with support. Ibarra was one. Yeah, I didn't, well, I wasn't a developer, but I helped out with the support and stuff. And during that time, I was actually doing 3D games myself. They were the consoles as well. Was it
console,
PlayStation?
And Sega Saturn and Dreamcast. You didn't know?
Yes, he did a lot of snowboarding. And this started out with steel slope slider.
That's right.
Yeah. And then sort of on that wave doing more snowboard games. And this got you into the idea of development and wanting to form your own studio. I wanted to do my old games, but I didn't have the impression, I didn't have the sensation of wanting to do my own company. It's more like before I knew it, I just sort of a company just fallen into my lap.
I'm interested, how did you start getting into developing games then? Where did that journey begin?
No, the reason I started was just simply because I liked games, and I've always, since I was a kid, wanted to sort of produce the games that I myself would want. Just make my own games.
You also have a museum exhibition of video game cassettes and video game history. Why did you want to do this?
No, I mean, I've collected a lot of games and I have a lot of games. And then I liked sort of the history from that. So I just figured, well, I might as well just display them. Yeah, it's in Tokyo, but it's not like it's open all the time. It's just a certain, now and then we display it. That's all.
Yeah. And if people want to look online as well, it's known as the Museum of Pre-Owned Game Collections.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of people who are collecting, you know, all the games and displaying them. But I wanted to do something different. So I just came to the point where I realized that a lot of people had written their names on the cartridges. And I find that history is interesting. So I figured I could do a museum that's doing that, because that's the only place in the world who's doing that. And when I was doing it, I figured it would be an interesting story if these cartridges were actually returned to their previous owners. So it just turned into some sort of that kind of activity.
Fantastic. So your studio is called Happy Meal. So tell us about the formation and why the name as well.
As I said, it wasn't really a case of where I wanted to create a company. It's rather that before I knew it, it just had become a company. And we needed a name for this. And I'd been in contact with a Finnish company called Digital Chocolate. And he figured it was fun to have something edible as a name for a game company. So I just copied that, and it turned out into a Happy Meal.
Wow.
By the way, is not the name of the set for a specific hamburger restaurant. It's in Japan, it's called something else. But
Coincidence.
Coincidence.
I was wondering how you met Imamura-san.
We have a common acquaintance that I have made game with previously, and he told me that Imamura is about to we're wanting to make a game together with him. How about you join us? And that's basically how it started.
Well, Imamura-san, did you think Omega 6 would ever become a video game? Did you want it to become a game?
Well, during my time at Nintendo, I created so many games, so I figured, well, I don't really necessarily need to do any more games, at least not for the moment. So I did this comic book instead. And then this Matsuya, this common acquaintance, he just came up to me and said, well, let's make a game out of this. And that's how that started.
Well, how did you go about updating that visual novel style for modern video game players?
The engine for this sort of adventure style game where you have commands that you can choose had already been done. The engine already existed, and Seki had already done three games in that particular engine. So it was the idea was just to take this engine, this system, and just paste Omega 6 onto it, use Omega 6 as a sort of narrative for this engine.
Where did the idea of having a rock, paper, scissor element in there for the turn-based battles?
I mean,
the comic book is obviously an action comic, and there's a lot of battle scenes in it. And we were doing it with an adventure game engine, so we were wondering how we're supposed to sort of do these battle things. We obviously couldn't have moving figures with action scenes, and if we created a battle system, similar to other games, it would probably become too complicated, and we didn't have much time for the development either. So while we were wondering how should we do battles in this kind of game, we figured that rock, paper, scissors is a thing that's international. Everybody understands it. It's a simple system. So we just came up with that, and it turned into a good thing in the end.
Well, I mean, there will be people here that are familiar with Omega 6, but there will be people that may be hearing about it for the first time. I mean, can you explain a bit about the world of Omega 6 and what kind of the narrative is there?
Omega 6 is actually based on an idea that I had when I first had my interview with Nintendo decades ago. So it's just to sort of finish that idea once I stopped at Nintendo. And I've always wanted to do some sort of space adventure thing. And I figured that I could do some sort of like taking this idea that aliens are coming, but they're not really fighting, not invading, but it's rather like the Earth is filling up with aliens and we have to do something about that because there is no more room for the humans. I wanted to expand on that idea.
Well, in the game, there's 100 unique aliens as well. How did you approach that and kind of get 100 done? It's quite a lot of work.
It's just general, what do you call it? Just inspiration. Just drew something.
Well, obviously the Nintendo Switch is a very popular console now. Obviously the Switch 2 came out recently as well. I mean, do you remember when you first saw the Nintendo Switch and did you see possibilities on that platform?
When the Switch was, I was still at Nintendo when the Switch was released, and the main impression from that console is actually that in the company there was this atmosphere of if this doesn't sell, then Nintendo is done for as a hardware developer, and we will just turn into games. And it was the Switch itself was a project from Iwata. Satoru Iwata, and he sort of passed away during the development of all this, and everybody thought that we would have liked to show him what a success it finally was.
I was wondered, has Miyamoto played Omega 6, and have you had any feedback from him?
I mean, he probably gets like 10 games a day at his desk that he's supposed to play, so I don't think he has the time. Well, maybe he's opened it and said, okay.
Put it on the to play pile later. Yeah. But there are some interesting mechanics in the game as well. I mean, one is the bonsai tree on the spaceship that produces power-up fruit. So what inspired that?
No, we figured that we were thinking about how we should produce items within the game. And we wanted to do something unique and something special, but we still wanted, so we spoke together and we figured that maybe a tree or some sort of vegetable, kind of, some sort of growing thing could do it. And we were talking about what would be an interesting, unique thing that everybody would know about. And we figured that bonsai is a thing that most people have heard about. And as Imamura said also that you cannot export them. They're forbidden to export. So, and it's also like Amazon's Jeff Bezos from Amazon. He also is like bonsai. They come to Japan just to look at people's collections, but they can't take them with them back. So we figured it would be a good thing because a lot of people know what it is, but hasn't seen it. I bought one just the other day. But unfortunately, it died. I understood that you had to treat it like a little baby every single day. Oh, his grandmother and grandfather made bonsai when he was a kid. And I remember they were really, really careful about these bonsai trees. But I was a kid and I was, you know, playing soccer beside it. And then I have a memory of being scolded for having a ball beside these trees. Yeah, and at the time I was like, well, it's just tree. But now that I'm grown up, I'm like, yeah, I really understand. And I'm sort of impressed that they actually didn't tell me off even more.
I was wondering about the physical releases as well, because limited run games have created a physical release. Do you intend on doing more, or do you intend on releasing it for other systems as well?
Steam も出てますね。Seki says that, well, personally, when it comes to limited run, I just want to say that personally, I like a box with a physical release. Imamura says that he doesn't care at all.
Do you think there's still value in doing physical releases? Because a lot of games now are digital delivery only. I mean, personally, I like having a game on the shelf in my collection. Do they still see value in that?
Well, obviously, Seki does and Imamura doesn't.
As
the designer of the game and as the artist designer, if you do a package, it's a lot of more work. It's just you need to have the art for the cover, you need to have art for the manual, and for the special box of 500 that he did, he needed to sign every single one of these 500. That's a lot of work. I threw him into a room and locked the door. And
I was wondering which elements in the game as well have kind of helped it have a strong replay factor. So elements like random elements in some of the battles and some of the kind of achievements that you can get in the game.
There are a lot of things that you can explore and that you can sort of divert into. So there are a lot of things that you can only do basically on your second run through. But two run throughs should be probably enough. There is luck in the battle, but there's also this sort of strategy for like how many cards you have left and how many cards the enemy has left. Mm. So there's an element of strategy there that, of course, you can mitigate the luck. Yeah, we try to aim for a sort of good balance between luck and strategy.
I'm wondering as well, do you think this kind of nostalgic Japanese manga game style has been missing from modern gaming, and why that approach to it?
SF とかファンタジーのゲームを見てると、
When it comes to science fiction games and fantasy games like that, it's almost as if the more complicated they are, the better. And I've always wondered why that is, because I don't agree with that at all.
I was wondering, working outside of Nintendo, was there more creative freedom?
I could do whatever I want this time. And I mean, I drew all the graphics myself, every single part.
How about the time scale as well? Was it more strict or a lot looser?
We didn't have the impression that it was actually stressful, because we were all pros and it went very smoothly. So didn't really need to hurry, but everybody did their part and everybody did the job. And there were so few people, so there wasn't any element of having a crunch or something like that. Yeah, normally when you do a game, Seki says that somebody's sort of getting late with some sort of, so they run into some sort of problem and everybody's got to wait for it. But this time, this just didn't happen. Everybody did their part and everybody finished on time. And when problems occurred, people had already solved them before we knew it.
Sounds very organized. I was wondering on the team, who else is involved as well, like musicians and...
We did with six persons. That is, Seki was the director, and then we had three planners, and there was one composer. So Imamura wrote the general plot for the game, but these how to split this up and how to divide this into sections was done by Seki and these three planners, who were sort of helping to sort of sort out the story. I actually asked him, because I personally didn't know exactly what a planner was in this case.
The main programmer was one.
And then we have one main programmer and about two support programmers.
Did you all work together in one place, or were people working remotely?
Yeah, we were in Tokyo, in Mie, in Osaka. It was 100% remote work.
It's interesting to hear a bit more about kind of how the approach to designing games has changed now. Obviously, you mentioned remote working there, but are there any other like major differences from, for example, when you were making stuff in-house at Nintendo?
Well,
the main thing that has happened is the game engines, of course. This time we were using Unity 3D. And one thing that you can say about Nintendo is also that they are so meticulous with every single detail of things that nobody will ever notice. Everything has to be checked. Everything has to be polished into the tiniest detail. Yeah, they're checking to see if that no programmer has entered some sort of, you know, code that shouldn't be there, or if they are using a certain library that they should not use, and so on. So it's a very, very, very strict check on. In the end, you will have just games there on the shelves and they will look like the same thing. But I think that Nintendo is probably the company in the world who does the most meticulous check of their code and every single detail of their games.
That Nintendo quality seal.
But in Omega 6, I was just said that I don't need my pay. We could just use my pay for the debuggers, so I don't have to do it.
I was wondering as well with how you chose which languages to translate it to as well, because there's a French version and there's quite a few international versions.
Personally, I think we don't need all these languages, actually.
Well, we'd love to give you guys a chance to ask any questions you've got of our panel. While we're thinking about that, though, just one thing. I mean, obviously, Omega 6 sounds like it's, you know, there's a lot more potential there as well. I mean, is there any plans to do any more games around the series, or kind of what is next for it?
If somebody just pays me, I'll do whatever. I want to do another 3D shooting game. It's been a thing that's been with me for a while.
And Seki-san, I was wondering, are there any further plans for Happy Meal? Anything coming up?
Happy Meal の中で次の企画とかっていろいろありますか? It seems that they have some sort of secret project going on, some sort of new game planned
that they can't talk about.
それが何なのかってまだ言えない。No, they can't talk about it. Not yet.
We'll find out in good time. Did anyone have any questions then for our panel?
We've got one coming.
Yeah, Paul Drury is coming down. Paul's always got a question.
From Retro Gamer Magazine. So.
That. I'd really like to ask a question to you, Gunji, about your past. I hope that is okay. I have seen that you worked on Twinkle Star Sprites back in the 1990s.
Yeah.
I love that game.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. I just wondered your memories of working on it, but also producing a game for the arcade. Is it very different to producing a game for a home console?
Yes, that's the biggest difference is that when you do an arcade game, the player should die within 3 minutes. So you have to sort of think about how am I supposed to give them a good an interesting gaming experience in 3 minutes. So that's why most arcade games become very difficult in stage two.
They want you to put more money in. Yeah.
And that was what Capcom had in mind when they made Street Fighter 2. So each stage is like 2 minutes or 90 seconds or something like that. And it turns much more difficult. And then a new person comes in and you've got these hectic 2 minutes and then you another player and so on. And if it's a one-player game, it's not a fighting game, but it's a one-player game, they usually make the first stage very easy. So you sort of get into the game and like in Fatal Fury, the second stage will become much more difficult.
We have another question.
After such a long time at Nintendo, what made you decide to leave?
Making a game and taking part of the game usually takes at least 2 years. So when I turned 50, I realized that until I turn 60, I can probably do maybe 5 more games, and that's it. And then I felt like about other things that I want to do and other games that I want to do, and I figured that I probably need to do something else by now. And I always wanted to make a comic book since I was a kid. I was sitting there in my office and drawing comics when I had some free time over. I'm telling everybody that I drew and created Omega 6 after I'd left Nintendo, but in fact I'd already started drawing it while I was there. maybe that's not a good thing to say officially.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here in Norway this week, and Seki-san, Imura-san, thank you so much. Please give them a big thank you.